Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to the Almas Podcast. My name is Gabrielle Love. I am your host on this wonderful, wonderful podcast where we get to meet just incredible people like today's guest, Lindsay. I am just super excited to hear all about Lindsay's story, life, journey, passions, really anything that Lindsay's feeling like talking about today. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
How about you tell us a bit about yourself, or, you know, really just introduce yourself however you feel?
Sure. So my name is Lindsay. My pronouns are she, her. I am originally from the Bahamas, and I have been living on the unceded and stolen territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people, aka Vancouver, Canada, since 2010. I originally came here for school as an illustration student at Emily Carr University of Art and Design. And since then, I have basically found my calling as a performer in the Vancouver burlesque community under the name Androsia Wild. And then also on the side, I am a witch practicing tarot reader and astrologer under the name Dark Lake Tarot.
Beauty. That is beautiful. Well, now I have questions for you. I mean, now I have questions. Well, how did those two things happen? But first, can you start with the names? How did you end up with those two names?
Sure. So no one is surprised when I say this, but I'm a giant nerd. So I love finding out the roots and histories of different things. And names have always been extraordinarily fascinating to me. You know, like back in the day, whenever you would find like these dinky little keychains or these like things that you find in like photo galleries and like strip malls, where you'd be like, oh, this is what your name means. And it's usually not accurate. But it was always really fun. And I had like one with my names, with all of my given names on them. And whenever I find a new or interesting name, I always want to find out what the root is. So one of the roots of my first name, Lindsay, is Scottish for Dark Lake.
Oh.
So when you are purchasing a reading from Dark Lake Tarot, you are purchasing a reading from Lindsay's Tarot. And I thought that was a lovely little way to have a little bit of my name magic be involved. And dark lakes are also kind of described as blue holes. And in the Bahamas, we have the third largest blue hole in the world. Actually, we have quite a number of blue holes in the archipelago. And I thought that was also just a small little like nod to my home country. I like involving emblems of my Bahamianess and everything that I do. And very randomly, I found out that there's a very strong chance I might have been conceived in Scotland. So and when I heard that, I was just like, well, I guess I'm definitely keeping the name. As for Androsia Wild, so when I first moved to Vancouver and I started getting involved in the alternative modeling scene and performing name, I went by an entirely different name that was more Japanese in origin, because that was just the name that I had growing up as a kid. And as I decided that I wanted to make burlesque more of a focus in my life, I wanted a name that was more authentic. So Androsia, that's A-N-D-R-O-S-I-A, is actually a style of batik fabric dyeing that is endemic to the Bahamas, specifically the island of Andros. Hence its name, Androsia. It's been around from, I want to say, like, what, the 1970s? So it's usually these beautiful, bold, jewel-toned, vibrant colors. And where with batik, you would normally have wax stampings of various shapes or creatures. It's a lot of indigenous flora and fauna that is often used in Androsia. So when I wanted to create this burlesque persona, I wanted something that was symbolizing something that was very uniquely Bahamian, but also sounded tropical and hinting that to people who don't know anything about the Bahamas, but people who are from the Bahamas will know why that name is important. And as it turns out, my husband, who is also from the Bahamas, his family is from Andros. So once again, I carry a little bit of a very important Bahamian tie with me wherever I go. So for the person who doesn't know anything about the Bahamas, it sounds like a lovely, exotic name. It tends to play on the phrase drove you wild, which, you know, why not for her burlesque persona? Yeah. And I've had some people think of Ambrosia, like the Ambrosia of the Gods, which I'm also very cool with. But definitely when I say my name to a Bahamian, they're like, oh, okay, we get it. You are a daughter of these islands, but you are still wild. Androsia Wild.
Beautiful. That is beautiful. I love how meaningful and interconnected the names are. I think that's beautiful. Yeah. I'm totally with you. I think names are such a beautiful, beautiful thing, and the way, like, a beautiful way to connect with different things that are meaningful to us. Like the Almas podcast is named after my grandmother for exactly that reason. Yeah. And a lot of the branding and the colors come from a very specific tribe in Ethiopia. So it's definitely, I'm with you. I love imbuing things with ancestry, with specifically ancestry, just because, you know, they're already imbued in everything. This is just a way of kind of like,
this is how we make our own connections, especially those of us from the diaspora, where those ties are already very hard to even track in some instances.
Exactly. Cool. So you have been in Vancouver for about 11 years now. Congrats.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I have been here about 5 months now. I mean, I was here a couple of years ago, but I think that I'll call this my official move. Wow. Let's start with the experience for you as someone in the diaspora sort of community, or you know, that being part of your identity. Maybe a curious question to start off with. What's that process been like for you, that journey of connecting with your roots, with your ancestry?
It's been really weird because that's not something that's very prevalent growing up in the Bahamas. Like, you originally being from Ethiopia, you know what it's like to grow up where you are surrounded by people of your own kind, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And then you come here to this city and it's like, where are all the Black people at? But at the same time, when I first moved here, I was itching to get away because for me at the time, being back home felt very stagnant. I was constantly being surrounded by ideals and ways of life that I didn't like, I didn't resonate with, and I knew that I needed to get out of there. Unless I was going to just continuously follow the same path of what I called at the time, very unfairly, mediocrity. So I was like 20 years old. I was itching to get off of that 21x7 mile rock. I needed to go. So I landed in Vancouver and I was super excited to just have my mind open to living in a larger city with ease of accessibility for transit and education and just getting to know people from all over the world. The nice thing, of course, is that I traveled with my now husband. We both went to school together.
Nice.
And so I had a tie to home, and obviously I talked to my family, my parents and stuff like that. So I was never like separated from home in that way, but I was very much loving everything that I was being immersed in. It wasn't until 2016 when I had to come back home to the Bahamas when I realized how much of a disconnect I was really suffering from. And even though I was still very much itching to go back home, because I mean, home is where my husband is, being around my family, being around my hometown, places that I recognized from a child, seeing how people have grown and evolved, like that type of community I don't have here in Vancouver. Like, I have friends, I have people who I communicate with and network with and work with, and I love them dearly, but they're not Bahamians. They're not Black people. And coming back to Vancouver after being home for 10 months was a huge eye-opener about how much that type of connection was really, really necessary just to make me feel sane. Obviously, it's a little bit harder still because communities here have been displaced and placed in areas that are not particularly accessible oftentimes. And being one of the few people from the Caribbean, let alone from the Bahamas, means that the number of individuals that I get to interact with are not as large as, say, people who find all the Jamaicans or heck, even all the people from mainland Africa. So there is a connection that I realized that I needed that I still haven't really been able to craft for myself in the same way. But I now, especially in this phase of my life, want to prioritize connecting with persons of color, connecting with members of the Black diaspora wherever I can. And that has definitely driven a lot of the factors in my own personal endeavors, especially through Dark Lake Tarot and through my performing opportunities as Androja Wild, because part of that is now ensuring that my Blackness is visible, even if no one else from the Black community necessarily sees it, because everyone's got their own stuff going on. I no longer want my Blackness or my Bahamianness to just be a passing fancy of who I am. I want it to be integral to who I am.
Absolutely. I'm totally with you. I'm smiling because everything you're saying, I totally resonate with. I'm completely with you. The last, I would say probably the last couple of years, this has really, really increased for me, like the presence of, in my life, of wanting to really connect with more people of color, and specifically people who are Black or Indigenous, because that's like I'm realizing more and more that the lack of that throughout my life has really contributed to me not really seeing myself as fully, like, you know, in the world. And that's because I wasn't engaging in spaces and with people that allowed me to see myself reflected in them, because I was constantly just around people that weren't reflecting me.
It's such an awful eye opener when you clue in on that. Like, it feels very, very sad. And unfortunately, that is compounded by the events of the last 4 years, let alone the last year.
Yeah.
Being extraordinarily stressful. Like, on the topic of, like, I want my Blackness to be integral to who I am. Last year sucked.
Yeah. 2020.
Really mildly, last year sucked to be a Black person. And I never had to have that brought into question in the same way. And trying to articulate that to other people, especially in the other communities that I find myself in, just became this exercise and just fatigue. And I hated it. But it was also necessary because I was one of the few bodies of color, so I had to do it. And my Blackness never felt like such a burden before, and that horrified me. Like, that actively horrified me. So especially after the events of last year, I was like, well, frig having that be the narrative that I want to go for. If this is going to be how you all are going to see me, and now that I'm aware that you see me like this, then y'all going to have to deal with my Black ass.
Yep. And you touch on an interesting point there. Now that I'm aware that y'all see me like this, because that's what it's been like for me. It's just becoming increasingly more aware of things I wasn't aware of at all before. And now that I'm aware of them, it's like, whoa, it's horrifying and also just upsetting. So much anger. 2020 was the year of anger for me, and it still very much is the year of anger now. Like, that anger has not died down. It is becoming more constructive, which is definitely a positive. But there's a lot of anger. Yeah,
so much anger. There's nothing like looking at communities and circles that you've been in for quite a number of years, and now wondering if every single action or interaction you've had with them is because they only saw you as a diversity token. That sucks. Sucks so much. And then also realizing that in some instances you probably were the diversity token because the interactions that other persons of color have had with certain communities have been far worse.
Yep. Oh God, you were speaking the truth. You are speaking the truth. What, how, like, so 2020 was, you know, hard and it sucked. How is that feeling now? Like, what has that kind of turned into for you now?
It's turned into a weird resignation and weariness that I don't want, but as you said, like choosing to channel that into something constructive is important, because otherwise I'm just going to become more bitter and angrier. And I don't want to be that way to people who, by all accounts, have been good to me, but through no action necessarily of their own, they're just not cognizant mm-hmm. of internalized systemic racist action. Mm-hmm. That, again, may not necessarily have been directed at me, and that I may not have ever necessarily felt with those circles. But now that we have had this collective wool pulled over our eyes at long last, I'd like to think, I refuse to allow persons to not hold themselves accountable. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my shift over the last year in particular, it was a shift that I was kind of happening like in the surface, but you know, 2020 brings everything to the table, that interacting and building community and space for BIPOC individuals, especially Black individuals when I can, is now my focus. Mm-hmm. So it means that I tend to look at opportunities that are being offered to me or that are out in my sphere. And I am now taking more note on when I am asked to participate, how I'm asked to participate, how others are being asked to participate. And I am now comfortable and have now been able to create community spaces where if I don't see what I need to see, I can just go to my BIPOC community creators and be like, all right, this is garbage, so let's just do our own shit.
Mm-hmm.
And we have.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's probably all that was missing in the past, is that we just haven't been doing it as much. Mm-hmm. And if we were, you know, it just wasn't as advertised. There wasn't enough exposure. And so Even whatever was available, people didn't know where to find it. And that like comes down all the way to like shopping. It takes so much effort to find products that are, you know, Black owned. Like it takes way more effort. It's not just a Google search away.
On the funny that you mentioned like finding Black products, this just reminded me, in my day job, I had a conversation with my new coworker who is originally from Guyana, which mm-hmm. is exciting because I have blood in South America. So we were just vibing and talking about like shared experiences, even though there's a bit of an age gap with us. And we cracked a joke about how hard it was to find makeup when we first moved here. And my other coworker who was in the room, a very lovely, sweet white lady, she came up to me afterwards. She's like, I had absolutely no idea that something like that would be so hard for you. And I'm like, yeah, kind of fucked up, right?
Yeah.
Like she didn't mean it in any which way. Again, she is one of the sweetest women I've ever met. But it's just like one of those things where you are able to go through your life not considering this particular vantage point. And I can understand why you would never have to consider that vantage point. But now I'm going to make it my life's mission to ensure that you don't ever make that mistake again.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know what? So that's tricky. That's a good conversation to have, because I find that very tricky. So I think in the past, just to give you some context, my mm-hmm. approach to kind of personal growth and personal development, that kind of thing, was pretty much, you know, it did involve other people, specifically where it's relationships or certain things that I'm working on that, you know, involves other people. But mm-hmm. for the most part, the work that I was doing was very internalized and independent. Mm-hmm. And this time around, you know, the last couple of years or maybe 3 years, up until probably like a few months ago, this whole work around my racial identity and you know, just discovering all of these different things about myself in relation to the world, that was very much internalized and independent. I was focusing a lot of it inwards and mm-hmm. at myself and with myself.
Which is important to still do.
Absolutely it is. Yes. And also, I had a conversation with someone probably a few months ago now, and they had said something along the lines of healing was never meant to be outside of community. It was always meant to be with community. And that for me really changed my perspective. And I thought, well, okay, how does that apply to this kind of work? How do I actually do this in a way that that is community focused. And that for me meant, oh, I guess I'm going to have to start pulling people of European descent into my experience, into my process and my journey, and really involve them in it. Not from a place of, you know, wanting to, or like needing them to do the work, because I definitely need them to do the work for sure. But also from, like, more importantly, from the place of, I actually need people to be involved and to be engaged to the same extent in order for this to work. Because I can do all this work all I want, and then you can do it, and all the people of color on this planet can do it. But if we don't, like, if we don't get people of European descent, or at least people who are benefiting, you know, from those privileges, to actually be involved in that formula, it might not work. And so, so I've been trying really hard to, like, really, really pull people in, which is really tricky, because half the time, honestly, I don't want to. Half the time, I'm just so tired. I just don't, I just want to, like, you know, no, that's how I feel. So it's really been making an effort there. What's that been like for you? Like, how are you, you know, aside from holding people accountable and really, like, getting people to become aware and to learn, how else are you kind of, like, bridging or building bridges with people in this, like, journey of your own journey?
I think a large part of that is also just learning to be a little bit more open with the stuff that I have been exploring and finding out about. And then just actively wanting to and prioritizing creating things with my community. So part of my work with Burlesque, as one of the co-founders of our first BIPOC inclusive group called Diasporic Dynasty.
Nice.
thank you. Has been specifically like, okay, we don't see ourselves often on stages. We are usually only cast one or two at a time as diversity tokens at best. And we know that we have important stories to tell, and we want to be able to create in a way that we are not catering to a white-centric gaze. We are not working with problematic performers or producers just in the name of being able to, you know, pay rent. We want to create experiences that are FUBU, for us, by us. So I think that has been, like, the most, like, liberating exercise for me. It's been communicating with these awesome performers in our community. It's about 30 of us all together, and about 7 to 8 of us that are, like, actively involved in, like, the event planning and stuff like that. So, like, for example, after all of the racial hoopla that eventually found its way onto the doorstep of the Burlesque community here in Vancouver, which, oh boy, that was fun. We decided, you know what, if this is going to be the opportunity for us to make our own way, then we're going to do it now. So we banded together. We managed to apply for a grant to KW Studios and won the grant to be able to create our first showcase, which I'm very proud to say was 98% casted and crewed by BIPOC individuals.
Fabulous. Amazing.
We literally only had, like, two white dudes involved.
Wow.
That's everybody amazing. Else was a person of color, which was really, really exciting. We ended up having our debut show in September, which was called Behold Us. And it was a rousing success. We've also been able to participate in this year's Vancouver International Burlesque Festival, both as presenters in a series of TED Talk style things called Tip Talks, talking about the importance of fostering BIPOC burlesque and what that means for us as members. And we also got to participate in the digital showcase, creating a really lovely group piece, which for the first time, I think for a lot of us, wasn't politicized to the point of feeling dreary or inciting. It was just a celebration of us in our joy, which is just as important in that whole conversation. And we were really excited to have that number be included in the showcase, right? That expressions of joy are just as valid, and in times like this, I dare say even more valid than constantly focusing on our grief and our rage and our anger, because that shit's tiring.
Exactly. It's so tiring. I love that. That is beautiful. My heart is so warm hearing about all of that. So what's, like, Is there more of that coming?
Yes.
Okay. And like where?
We're actually getting ready to produce our first in-person showcase as part of the Vancouver Mural Festival in August. So that's, we're currently in the works for that. We're assembling our cast. We have our production crew pretty much on lock. So that's my next project with them, working behind the scenes to bring that together. So I am thrilled to see how that's going to turn out.
Oh my God. I'm thrilled too. That's so exciting. I almost want to scream. I was really close to screaming there. I just didn't want to interrupt you. That's awesome. Wow. Cool. So, okay. I'm kind of pivoting here, but if you want to talk more about that, go for it. At any point, Dark Lake Terror. So it kind of sounds like maybe this was something that, you know, there were seeds throughout your life. And then at some point, you discovered, oh, wait, this is actually me. So, tell us that story.
Okay. So once again, I'm a giant nerd, and therefore this influences everything that I do. The large joke is often like, people are like, oh, don't let your kids read Harry Potter because it's going to lead them to witchcraft. And I'm like, Harry Potter didn't lead me to witchcraft. Sailor Moon did, but that's an entirely different conversation. But my interest in tarot started off at school. So we were doing this illustration project where we were meant to take a series of images, but then render them in a tactile way. And because I was reading about King Henry VIII and his horrible treatment of his six wives, I wanted to play around with the idea of turning the wives of Henry VIII into playing cards. So I started doing a lot of research on card playing games from that era, how card playing games have evolved over the years, which of course leads me to the tarot, because that's exactly how it started off, as a card game. And someone was like, oh, are you going to create like a full deck? And I'm like, I don't know about all of that, because that's like 78 illustrations and I've already given myself an injury from art school. So drawing is hard, but you know, it might be fun to understand how they work and maybe collect ideas and see if that's actually something I really want to do. So then that turns into, well, if I'm going to be collecting ideas and seeing how it works, I should probably buy a deck.
Yeah.
And see how that works. And then it's like, okay, well, I picked up my first deck and I really love the illustrations of it. And I'm like, okay, well, let's see how people use this. So then I would like practice on myself and I practice with my friends, like trying to craft certain things. I'm like, okay, this is all really cool and dandy. And then it somehow just became a fixture in my life. And then as I started reading for people who weren't my friends, like I shouldn't say weren't my friends, people who weren't like my close friends.
Yeah.
So people who I am like a little bit more distant from, or I'm just getting to know, and I was still able to give them wisdom and clarity without knowing much about their situation, it then turned into a, oh, snap, I might actually be good at this. And hilariously, I came into that realization when I was home in a place where talks of magic and anything that isn't decidedly Christianity is definitely not encouraged.
Yeah.
But it was also one of the most grounding things that I had in my arsenal at that time. So when I came back to Vancouver, I was like, okay, let's see how I can legitimize this. So then it became a daily practice for me. I started branching out into offering the occasional reading for, again, outside of my general social circle. And then one day I decided, well, I guess I'm going to try and turn this into an actual business. So then I got my business license. I talked to a local tea house on Broadway and Kingsway. And I was doing tarot readings there every other Wednesday for like 2 years.
Wow.
Which was really, really cool. Obviously, I don't know if that's ever going to pop back again just because of how the pandemic has completely ruined my ability to want to be in a restaurant. But that was such a really awesome time in my life. I'm so happy I actually like got to say, like, I did tarot readings in a tea house. Like, that was really cool. And now, obviously, all of my readings and stuff have moved digitally, but it's still the same thing. I get to create an opportunity to give wisdom and clarity and guidance to people, be them people who I will never meet or people who I am very, very dear and close to. And I like it. I like it a lot.
I love it. Yeah. So hold on. What gave you the idea for the tea house?
Well, I was researching where people like do tarot readings live. For example, and I did find that a very common thing was people would go to tea houses across like the United States and in Europe. And heck, there was a lady who was even doing it in Canada before I even came to the country. That was just doing tarot and tea was just a thing. That was a very common pairing. So when I went to this particular tea house, it was like, it's super small, it's super cozy. It had these beautiful like birdcage chairs and gilded black and gold. And I'm like, ooh, I could work with this. And I love me a good cup of tea. So I plucked up my courage one day and I was just like, hey, I come here a lot. I have an idea for something I'd like to try. It's, you can totally like say no. And the manager at the time was like, no, this is cool. Let's do it. So I'm very grateful to her for giving me that opportunity and helping me establish a relationship with the owners that basically continued on until the pandemic shut that all down. But who knows? Maybe when I'm fully vaxxed and the world is a little bit closer to normal, I'll consider doing something like that again.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I hope you do. I've never heard of a tarot reading at a tea shop, personally. I've never seen this. I've never heard of this. This is completely new to me. And I love that you just kind of had this idea and you mustered up the courage and you just went ahead and did it. And you make that sound so incredibly easy. Like I would imagine under any other circumstance, it would be like you'd go and they'd say no, and you know, you'd be rejected. And then you'd go to a next tea shop and that would just keep happening until eventually someone says yes. But yeah, you make that sound very easy. It's almost like it was supposed to happen as easily as
I'd like to think it was supposed to happen. Absolutely. I mean, not to say that I didn't pull tarot cards to see how I was going to work out with that, but I may have done some work to help in that.
Oh, nice, nice, nice. That's awesome. I think earlier you mentioned that back home, like the Christian influence is now sort of like, yeah, witchcraft is bad, whatever. But there must be, like, I imagine there is a history there of witchcraft or some sort of pagan tradition.
Yeah, I mean, as an area that had, you know, African persons plucked against their will and brought over to that region of the world for slavery, ancestral traditions carried over. You'll hear about it in places like Cuba and Haiti, where Santeria and voodoo and hoodoo, if we talk about like even like a larger catch-all term, was prevalent. For us in the Bahamas, it turned into Obeah. So that's O-B-E-A-H.
Yep.
But Obeah is outlawed.
Oh, back home. Interesting.
It is actually in our penal code where a fine and I think about 3 to 6 months jail time can be issued if someone is found or suspected to be practicing Obeah.
Wow.
Under the section of moral decency.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that you could define moral decency, but.
Oh, they try. Wow. It's those types of attitudes I tried to leave at home.
Wow, that's wild. Do you know like the history of like how that came about?
Yeah, it's colonialism.
Right. But
it's just colonialism. It's Christian and British powers that wanted to stamp down on anything that wasn't what they knew, because anything that wasn't what they knew scared them. And it was either assimilate or die. Mm-hmm. And we don't have the history of Haiti where they were able to actually overcome their oppressors, right? Yeah. We asked for our independence peacefully, but we still have the Queen of England as our friggin' constitutional monarch. So, like, not to cast, like, light or shame on anybody who is of the African diaspora and finds themselves identifying with Christianity. Like, my parents are Christians. My brother is a Christian. Whatever. Yeah. Do what makes you happy and gives you bliss. But there's such a cultural mind rape that I think people back home just choose not to pay attention to. And they swallow these half-truths, full parcel. And it leads to some very awful and hateful things. It leads to people being closed-minded about other religions. It leads into being closed off about different belief systems. I won't even get into how they treat queer people back home or even in my home region, because that's just angers me. And I'm not even queer. And it's just very sad, because I think if we had instances where, you know, we could talk about, you know, wanting to preserve all culture, that means preserving all aspects of our culture. And that's not to say that I don't think that Obeah isn't being practiced back home. I'm pretty sure it is.
It probably is.
I just know that because I'm now so far away, my ability to find those corners where it is hidden and talked about, just so that I can learn just for myself, is so removed from me that that aspect of connectivity is actually a little heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. So I have to find adjacent roots to reconnect to ancestral magic.
Yeah.
Some of those conversations have been actually more beneficial than I thought. For example, when I finally fessed up to my parents about me being a tarot reader, I was very worried about what they were going to say, obviously. And my mom, nowhere to lie, says, well, you were always a little weird, so this makes sense. And I'm like, I've been sweating about this for years, and y'all are just cool with it? How dare you?
That's all there is to it.
That's all there is to it. And then when I – here's a fun story. So I love tarot decks that – talk about ancestral heritage, right? So two of my most prized possession decks are created by Black creators. Mm-hmm. One of them in particular is called the Akamara Tarot. That's A-K-A-M-A-R-A. Mm-hmm. And it was created with the mind of all encompassing different aspects of ATR, or African traditional religion or spirituality.
Wow. Cool.
Right? And as I'm flipping through one of the guidebooks for the deck, I recognize an illustration as a depiction of a slave being tortured.
Oh.
But it's done in a very, like, very artisanal way. So, like, if you're not familiar with what this particular, like, etching is, you're not going to know what's going on. But when I looked at the description, I specifically saw that they were referencing the indigenous ancestry of my mother's home country, which I had never heard about.
Wow.
So when I saw those two and I made that connection, I immediately called my mom, just like, what do you know about Winti? Mm-hmm. And she's like, huh, I didn't think you'd actually ask me about that. I can tell you what I remember. So then it led to this really lovely conversation about her telling me about traditional Winti practices, how Winti is still legal in Suriname, to the point that, like, wedding ceremonies can be done in the Winti religion and they'll be legalized. Mm-hmm. She always said that, you know, she was always pretty terrified about the stories that they would hear about Winti services and stuff like that, which I was like, okay, that's understandable. But she helped me kind of fill in the gaps a little bit about some of the things that she remembered. And then I told her, like, you know, oh, some of these practices are something that are things that I do. And she's like, what do you mean? It's like, oh, you know, like cleaning down the tub with Florida water and using herbs every once in a while in a bath. And she burst out laughing. She's like, you really are a Surinamese child. And I'm like, that is probably the most important thing you could have ever said to me in my entire life. So, like, there are small ways that I've been able to, like, draw those connective ties. Mm-hmm. It's just significantly harder being here, right? Mm-hmm. Because I have to basically do them all from a scholastic, academic standpoint. I can't really talk to people the way that I would want to because I'm not in the country, or I would risk, you know, the wrong person finding out. And this is the thing that bugs me the most. The wrong person finding out and deciding to rat to authority, or even worse, rat to my parents under the guise of, oh, we want to make sure that, you know, Lindsay's not getting up to horrible things. Meanwhile, you know, I'm a grown woman living elsewhere. Like, you don't have to look out for me in this capacity. But it's just that type of nature that is very prevalent and feeds a lot of disinterest, apathy, bigotry about ancestral practices that are just held over from colonialist brainwashing. It's really all it is.
Yeah, no, it totally is. And it's so sad and unfortunate. And also, like, I find it almost confusing, like, the irony of it all. Like, if we take something like Christianity, doesn't have its origin in Europe, you know, it like it came from the Middle East, and yeah, it was, like it traveled from the Middle East to Africa. That, you know, same with Islam. It like mm-hmm. it didn't like a lot of the modern day sort of Western ideals aren't even Western. Like they're not from Europe, but somehow it's managed to become this thing that is now like an emblem of colonialism, which is just yep. very confusing. It's very yep. very confusing. And yeah, it's very confusing. And for me, like as an Ethiopian, I find that it's even more confusing because I know that my ancestry has like a very close connection to Christianity. Like it's been close to it from a very long time, almost like closer to it than many other places.
Exactly.
And it, like somehow it's like that connection has branched out to all of these different things. And now you have this like brainwashed colonial version of it that mm-hmm. is very disconnected from its roots. And that's mm-hmm. the majority, well, actually not the majority of the population, but there's an increasing population of Ethiopians that have taken on that perspective rather mm-hmm. than the one that's kind of a lot more ancient and traditional.
And it's truer to your cultural history.
Yes, yes, exactly. And it's very, 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 very confusing, all of it. Like the irony is just mind-boggling. I don't yeah. know how this even managed to happen. Like,
it's yeah, just- but if I tried to entertain that conversation with like the average Bahamian back home, they'll just call me a devil worshiper and move on with their day. So I just don't bother.
yeah, exactly. Here's a question for you. So sure. Presently in your life, what's present in your life now? And if, you know, a lot of that is what we've been talking about so far, that's great. But if there's anything that maybe we haven't talked about that is mm-hmm. present in your life, let's mm-hmm. hear about that.
What's present now, at least as far as what I concentrate on, is more of a role shift and just kind of embracing the idea that I have something of value that is worth sharing with other people and worth mm-hmm. assuming a role of leadership, mentorship, teaching, etc. Mm-hmm. There's some unprogramming that I had to do on that. But that's just been kind of like flavoring some of my paths. So instead of wanting to be on the stage, I no longer need to be on the stage. I would much rather help guide someone else onto the stage, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So like, for example, with my burlesque stuff, I've been taking on more focus on production. I really want to get into producing more BIPOC-friendly spaces and performance venues mm-hmm. To ensure that people in the community, especially BIPOC individuals, especially trans individuals that wouldn't otherwise have a safe place to be able to rehearse or plan their art. I've partnered with a couple of friends of mine from out the burlesque community, and we now co-run a studio together called Show mm-hmm. Pony Studio.
Nice.
Which has been really fun to do. We're very rapidly approaching our very first year. And yeah, we started it during a pandemic, not the smartest move, but it was still a necessary space to try and save. And I'm very proud of the work that we're doing to keep financially accessible and safe rehearsal space viable mm-hmm. for performing artists and people just who want to create art. And I've launched my own tarot course, which is very terrifying. But
oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's called Rediscover. It's actually getting ready to wrap up at the end of this month. It was my very first time doing a full-on mentorship with people who want to learn how to use the tarot, and it's been going really well, and I might actually want to do it again.
You might.
I might. I mean, like, you know, it's as you can tell, I wear a lot of hats. I do yeah. a lot of things. I am not good at pacing myself. I'm not good at it at all, but I always feel like, you know, if there's something that is worth doing that I'm excited about, then I should want to do it. Mm-hmm. So I tend to overburden myself sometimes in that capacity, but this has been really lovely, even with some of the challenges in time management. But I get really lovely feedback from my students. I have students. I get lovely feedback from them about how much they value what I have to say. And that's not something I am used to hearing about myself, or I don't allow myself to believe can be said about me. Mm-hmm. So that's been great.
That's wonderful. Can I just ask, like, what changed for you? At what point did you go from, you know, I'm doing all this stuff and this is great, to, I think I could actually teach this stuff, or I want to teach this stuff? Like, what inspired that or triggered that change?
I think I've always wanted to kind of move into like teaching. I think the difference is a lot of respectability politics I had to personally unlearn on myself. So, you know, like the idea is just like, okay, if you're going to be teaching this thing, then you need to have like, you know, some sort of experience or moral authority. And I've taken classes from, not necessarily on tarot, but I've taken various classes from various individuals who are practicing astrologers or witches or magicians. And most times I then find out something deeply problematic about them, which taints the work that they have done in my own personal growth. And I never want to be in that position. Like I try to operate on very strict moral ethics on myself. Obviously I'm not perfect. I'm human. I'm sure I'm going to make mistakes along the way, but the idea that I had to be this paragon of virtue was so strong in my head. And it took a lot of self-reflection and shadow work and excavating throughout my own neuroses to kind of realize that A, perfection is a capitalist construct, and we can already see the capitalist constructs are not doomed, are not meant to last, they're doomed to fall. So why hold yourself to it? And if you constantly wait for the perfect time, it's never going to show up. So a lot of it was like, you know, exploring my own astrological blueprint with my own studies, talking to some other people, getting hyped up on my hubby, and then just deciding, you know what, screw it. Let's see what happens. And people were really supportive. What I was really surprised at was a lot of my friends who saw what I was doing were like, can we pay for a BIPOC student to take your course? And that was so awesome and so humbling that people not only see the value in what I want to do and what I want to offer, but also believe in putting their money where their mouth is and committing to, you know, active anti-racist work, which would be, hey, if a BIPOC person, if a Black person in particular can learn from a fellow Black person, I want to help facilitate that so that they don't have to worry about the financial obligation part of it. And that was so, so warming to me. And I'm so incredibly grateful to all of my friends who donated their finances to that cause, because it means now my class is half BIPOC people. And that's great.
Wow. I'm a little speechless. Let's put it that way. I'm feeling very, very warmed by that. Wow. I did have a question that came up while I was listening. So one of the things that I've kind of been thinking about a lot is how to make things equitable. And the thing that I realize is important for me is to structure pricing differently for different people, just because that seems fair to me. It doesn't seem fair to have the same pricing structure. But I really struggled with that in the beginning of really thinking about that and kind of feeling like guilt maybe, or not so much guilt, but that it would scare some people away. And then finally, I kind of hit a point where actually I don't care. I care more about what I think is the right thing to do than
it's
I do.
It's always that moment where you're just like, I don't give a fuck anymore. Let's just do it.
Exactly. Those are the good kinds of moments. So how have you been navigating that? Like making things equitable?
So my initial aversion to that was more like, okay, I operate on the how do I want to be treated? And despite everything that I have said thus far, I don't want to be treated as a charity case. Right? I understand and recognize that due to my upbringing, due to various life privileges that I've had, I'm usually able to pay my own way through anything. And if I can't do it, I'm not going to do it. That's just the way that I am. And where I have been, I have allowed myself the opportunity sometimes to take advantage of, like, say, like a reduced rate for BIPOC individuals. I had to overcome a lot of guilt in that instance. It was just like, oh, what if I'm like taking this from another person who actively needs it? It's like, no, your needs are valid. They're just different. Right. So I had to kind of get out of my own head on that one. And when it came down to pricing things for other people, it was more like, okay, what is the balance? I want to ensure that my time is valued because I'm putting in a lot of work into the things that I'm offering. I am putting in time and managing my website and paying for subscriptions to deal with certain things, assistance in creating the course and stuff like that. Like, all of that takes time and money, absolutely. And I want to ensure that anybody who is getting a course from me is getting value for their buck. So there are certain things that have to be like a non-negotiable. Like, you have to be able to reach me. You have to be able to ask me for advice. I have to make myself emotionally available to you if you are trusting me with your time and your funds. Thankfully, when I came out with the tiered pricing for Rediscover, I didn't have any pushback about, oh, well, why do you have a different rate for these persons? Because I think, again, the narrative nowadays, especially with everything that's happened last year, she's like, hey, not everybody is this rich white person in Yale Town who has a yacht and can just drop money at the drop of a hat. BIPOC individuals, especially if you're an immigrant, you have to make very different financial decisions. There's so many things that I want to be able to do, and I can't do them usually because of time, but also because of money. So if I'm going to make it easier for somebody to pursue something that they are interested in, then I'm going to do it. I basically approached Rediscover's pricing like this. I had one tier tier pricing for BIPOC individuals, and I had one that was a little bit higher for non-BIPOC individuals. Each version had a payment plan. So you could, if you can pay the money up front, cool. If you want to do a pricing plan for it so it's spaced out a little bit more, cool. Is the pricing plan I have not enough? Talk to me. We can work something out. I don't mind creating a bespoke payment plan for you if that is what you need. What's more important to me is that you don't feel like you're all of a sudden trapped in this financial obligation. And, you know, financial classism is a thing that stretches across racial barrier. Right? So just because you are a white person, for example, doesn't mean I expect you to pony up that amount up front, because that's not how it works. You have a payment option. You have the option to talk to me. And I know what it's like to drop money that you don't have on courses. There have been a couple of courses that I've taken that have been close to a grand, and in hindsight, shouldn't have done that.
I feel you.
And it's like, so I never wanted to get to that particular point. I just want, and I never necessarily want to get to the point where it's just like, oh, I'm going to be making money offering things that I really and truly learned for free. But it's more like, if you're paying me, you are just recompensating my time, and you are saying that what I have to offer has value. But I'm always going to make sure that whatever I have offered is financially accessible. That's just the way that I'm programmed. And that was the same idea with Show Pony Studio when we were talking about how we were going to do our pricing, because, you know, renting a studio space is not cheap, especially in this city. So we had to be able to balance, what do we need to do minimum to keep our costs low, but also pay our rent?
Right. Yeah.
And usually people have been extraordinarily understanding about those things and don't offer pushback. If people are in a position, and we have had this where people have been like, hey, I want to help. Here's a couple $100 to help float you for a bit. I'm like, that's great. Because they believe in the work that we're doing. And I think that's the most important thing. You believe in what you're doing, and you can see that this type of work is needed. So you're able to help in whatever capacity you are.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like, just to go back a bit there, communication is super important in that, just really communicating why we do certain things and mm-hmm. like why they're important. That can really go a long way, because mm-hmm. I think with just a little more clarity around what is going on, can really help inform decisions for people. Mm-hmm. But if you don't really understand what's going on, then yeah, you're not likely to do anything about it. But I just have a side note. I do have to say, I've been like on a lot of retreats and taken like lots of like courses and stuff like that. And I think some of them don't actually make sense to me in terms of their pricing, because some of them are like $30,000 for a week retreat.
Oh my God, like, are they feeding you?
it's like, is it really that much more value than the other retreat that I could do for like a third of that price? Like, what exactly are you going to be offering?
People high? What on earth? I'm sorry. Like, those kinds of things just boil my blood. I can't do it.
Yeah. It's
part of me would have that thought. What?
Yeah, I almost did it. I have to say, I almost did it, and I didn't. And I still sometimes wonder, you know, I don't know if the price is that high, does that mean the value will be that much more? Like, is it going to be that much more of an impact? I don't know.
You can price yourself whatever you want to whatever you think your value is. And you know what, you got costs to pay off, and I understand all of that, but you have got to have, you know, brass cojones to just be like, yeah, it's $30,000 for a week. It's what?
Yeah. Those are my thoughts. I think some of those, I've come across a lot of those, and I just think, wow, okay. I mean, this is interesting.
I admire your confidence, and I would love to get to that point one day, but I refuse to pay to offer anything for something that I even can't reasonably afford for my own damn self, let alone asking strangers on the internet to pay that for me. I can't do it.
Yeah, it's wild. The capitalism is an interesting thing. It's a very, very interesting thing. I mean,
it is. And especially like in the magical communities, I understand, especially with attitudes like that, why people would balk at the idea of a tarot reader charging. They would be like, oh, if it's supposed to be this spiritual gift, then why are you charging? I'm like, because I got rent to pay.
yeah. And you're also, I've struggled with that quite a bit. And I think now it's very simple for me. You're giving your time, and time is pretty much like the most valuable thing you've got. And so if you're offering your time, they're not paying for the tarot, you know, or the information. They're paying for time out of your precious life.
I think I broke it down on my website at one point. Just like, I have to make time out of my schedule when I am not at work. So you're already getting me on what is technically like time that I'm not being paid for. Then I have to sit down with you. I have to make myself emotionally available for you. I have to make sure the recording of our time goes well. I have to get photos of our stuff properly. I need to combine all of that into a way that you can easily access and format. And I have to do it within a certain time limit, because you want to have the stuff ready and available when it's fresh in your brain. That's like 2-3 days worth of work.
Yep, exactly.
So pay me. Exactly. So pay me. It used to be much nicer about that, but and again, thankfully, I've never gotten like pushback in that instance, because people do understand that type of time. But it is very much like I'm not justifying this to you all anymore. I worked. Pay me.
Exactly.
Unless you all are going to be turning into my sugar daddies and helping me pay my rent in Vancouver, just pay me.
yep. Just pay me. It's so funny. I think about this and I think like, even 5 years ago, none of this stuff was stuff that I was really like actually, you know, convinced of. I didn't have this conviction that I have now. So it's definitely been a process of learning and unlearning. Oh, yeah. And
knowing you have value and that value deserves to be compensated. What a wild, radical concept.
Yep. So radical. It's out of this world. So radical. My God. Okay. So this has been a beautiful, beautiful conversation. I've had such a good time. I hope you've had a good time.
I have. This was lovely.
Lovely. And I had no idea the connection between Lindsay and Dark Lake. Like, I had no idea. That's super, super cool. I'm sure nobody else knows either.
No, it's, I did put it on my website because somebody did ask me once before. I'm like, it might be interesting information, but yeah, you're getting a piece of me, which is the whole point.
That's right. That's right. Well, thank you for sharing that. And do you have any final thoughts before we wrap this up?
Yeah. Prioritizing Black folks, prioritizing Indigenous folks, prioritizing people of color is more than just giving us the microphone. It is actively ceding power. That is the most uncomfortable aspect that even now, after everything has happened, I don't think people realize. You have to cede power. You have to walk away. You have to be content with not being in the spotlight anymore. And you don't deserve kudos or cookies for doing that either. So just, if this is the work that you want to do, if you want to be like, I'm going to commit myself to actual allyship, I'm going to commit myself to actual anti-racist action, then you have to consider how all of your actions still continue to reinforce certain status quos that are still harmful. And oftentimes the easiest way to ensure that the scales are balanced once again is to step away from the platform altogether. Because we can handle it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, of course we can. Of course we can. I have so much to say about that, and I'm just gonna leave it there. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I will be sure to add all of the places that people can find you. But if there's somewhere specific that you would like people to connect with you the most, feel free to say that now. And
yeah. That all kind of depends on how much of me are you willing to find. So cool. If you want to find me for tarot, astrology, magic guidance, I am at Dark Lake Tarot on Twitter and Instagram. If you would rather follow my sparkly showgirl adventures, I am at Androsia Wild on Instagram. And if you're interested in seeing what Show Pony Studio gets up to, also on Instagram, that is showpony.studio.
Beautiful. Love it. Thank you. And you know, I hope to have you back someday.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
And that was another episode with Lindsay, aka Dark Lake Tarot, aka Androsia Wild. I have to say, I didn't even do that much talking, but for some reason, my voice is almost gone. That was beautiful, wasn't it? I mean, I was saying to her after we, you know, stopped recording that I had a few moments there of just like feeling warm and fuzzy and speechless and not knowing what to say. And I was really happy that she had a lot to say because I didn't have to insert myself with any commentary, and I could just focus on the kind of sensations that were present for me. That was really, really beautiful. I wish we had more time. I'm going to invite her back, and because I think there's way more that we could talk about, and there's more for her to share. Anyway, thank you for tuning in and listening, for sharing. Please do share this far and wide. If you've got any questions, comments, feel free to reach out and connect with Lindsay. I will be sure to add all, you can probably see it in the description. It is in the description. You can find her in connect with her in three different ways and probably other ways as well, maybe. Thank you. This was the Alma's Podcast, and we'll catch you next time.